Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. Special thanks to WKDZ, your Ag Edge Network, for their help in bringing you this show. On this week's show, our host will visit with Dr. Chris Teutsch from the University of Kentucky to discuss how to get better production from our pastures. Dr. Teutsch will also join in on discussing this week's topic, tips for livestock producers and how they should good weather high fertilizer prices, and we will wrap things up with this week's timely tip. As always, thanks so much for joining us, and we hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay. How are you this morning?
Doing good. Vicki, how are you today?
I'm doing well.
Good. Glad to have Dr. Chris Teutsch with us from UK Research and Education Center, Grain Forage Center of Excellence. He's going to visit with us today and talk a little bit about how we can get better productions out of our pastures. So, Chris, good to be with you today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Good. Glad to have you. Tell us just a little bit about yourself and the work that you've been doing since you've come to Kentucky.
So I've been in Kentucky about almost 5 years now, and we've been really focusing on work that's kind of has practical applications. So we've done a lot of grazing work with summer annual grasses, done a lot of variety testing work with summer annual grasses, and a little bit of stockpiling and novel endophyte work also.
Wonderful.
Yeah, that's it's been really good working with you, and we've all learned a bunch. But one of our ag issues, I guess, for today is going to be talking about how do we get better production from pastures. And you know, we always talk about, you know, if we could graze for 365 days out of the year, Dr. Teutsch, we'd probably try to do it. But it's kind of tough to do, and you have to do some different management tips and different management practices to be able to do that.
Yeah, so grazing 365 days a year is kind of the holy grail of grazing.
Isn't that the truth?
But the reality is if we look at it, the budgets for cow-calf operations, you know, really grazing 300 days a year is probably going to be the most profitable. When we get really extended out there, those last 60 or 65 days is going to cost you a lot of money, and it may be cheaper to feed a little bit of hay in that system.
Yeah, you know, and I guess I've been working on trying to graze 365 days a year for lots of years, and we've done some different things, and I guess the best I've ever done is 70 days. I didn't have grazing for my cattle for 70 days.
So, yeah.
But like you said, I mean, you know, if we could do that year in, year out, I mean, that is the holy grail, and we could do some of those things. Tell us a little bit about, you know, maybe some things that in the wintertime we're all, you know, kind of focused on hay feeding, but tell us some things that maybe we should be doing during the spring or summer and then kind of into the fall, things that we can do to help prolong our grazing.
So there's a number of practices that we can use, and probably the one that's going to give us the best bang for our dollar that we put into the system would be stockpiling for winter grazing. There's probably not a better or more economical way to feed animals during the winter months than stockpiling tall fescue. That's simply deferring grazing in late summer and fall, and then starting that grazing as we get into early winter. That's going to be your most economical way to feed cows.
Yeah, you know, and we've been doing that on our home farm there for a long time, and you know, we've done some different things to try to. We've dry lotted cows, we've grazed cows on corn stalks when we had the opportunity to do that, which are all great things to do. But you almost, and we've talked about this a little bit, is you almost have to have a way to have enough acreage or to something to keep those cows off of what you're trying to stockpile. We've started, and we can talk a little bit about bale grazing a little bit too, but we've kind of started doing that to help prolong that grazing period this winter to help, you know, kind of prolong that throughout the wintertime.
Sure. Well, you know, one thought there, and this is something that I've kind of kept in the back of my mind during the whole time y'all have been talking. We've known for years that one of the most limiting factors to profitability for a beef producer is that cost of stored feed. Mm-hmm. And Chris, that's really the way that I look at stockpiling our pastures as, is that's the cheapest stored feed that we really can produce. Because in effect, that's what it is. You said deferring. We're in effect storing that pasture that we would produce in late summer and on into the fall and using it later in the year. So yep. That's just a thought for people to keep in mind.
You know, one of the other practices that when you combine it with stockpiling that can really enhance grazing is if you're rationing that forage out with strip grazing. So you just start at your water source and just give them enough for maybe 3 days at a time. You're moving a fence twice a week or three times a week. That's going to increase the number of grazing days you get by about 40% because they're not trampling a bunch of forage down there. They're essentially having to eat what you give them.
I think that's a great, I mean, bringing that up, I know that we've done some of that on some trials here in Webster County with you, and a lot of interest of just producers driving down the road and seeing, you know, what we were doing and seeing that it can work in different systems, not necessarily just stockpiling, but even like your summer annuals that we may talk about here in a little bit. But I think, too, one of the things that, back to stockpiling, is that, you know, we talk about weather a lot with like grain production. That's always in the back of our minds. But when we start talking about stockpiling, I mean, the weather also that's a big factor that we have to pay attention to, too. I believe that to be true, you know, that we have to really watch the weather and if we've got enough moisture and that type of thing. So we sometimes forget about that on the forward side.
Yeah, and with current fertilizer prices this fall, you know, we saw that when we were thinking about doing some stockpiling, we looked at fertilizer prices, nitrogen prices, and I thought, wow, that's pretty high, but it's not as high as it's going to be, but right. Here in the near future. But you know, we looked at that and we said, no, we're not going to do that. But we had almost perfect conditions there locally at our farm there to not put fertilizer on, but stockpile grass without putting nitrogen on, and talk a little bit about that. You know, we've talked about that before, but talk a little bit about how that works, Dr. Toitz.
So our general recommendation has always been about 60 pounds of nitrogen in late summer to stimulate that stockpile growth. But what we're seeing is that with a good grazing system, so you're doing rotational stocking and you're incorporating legumes into your grazing system, and that rotational stocking gives you a better distribution of dung and urine in your pastures. You're building a stronger nitrogen cycle in that pastures. And sometimes in well-managed pastures, we don't get the response to that 60 pounds of nitrogen that we would expect. So the point that I'm trying to make is that with a well-managed grazing system, you may not need to put nitrogen on in the fall. The best way to kind of evaluate that on your farm is to do a little trial. If you have traditionally put 60 pounds of nitrogen on, I'm not going to tell you to stop, but I'm going to tell you to leave some strips out and see what kind of production you get from those strips. And you may be surprised that you're getting better growth than you think.
Yeah, I think this year was an example for us there locally. But yes, you know, we had that happen. We, matter of fact, we left a big strip off. We didn't do the whole farm. So yeah. we did get to see what kind of production that we had. And we've been strip grazing since, I think, Kevin Laurent came to me with this project back in 2006. So we've been strip grazing in the wintertime, giving the cows enough grass for about 3 days. We've been doing that ever since then. So, I mean, we do rotational grazing in the summer and those type things. So, you know, we've been doing that for a long time. So hopefully that's paying dividends now, and it's never too late to start. You can start doing that right now. It's a pretty easy thing to get started with. A few step-in posts and a little bit of wire and one of those little wire reels. People will be surprised at how much fencing you can do for your cattle in a afternoon. You know, 3 or 4 hours, I can probably fence enough for a couple of weeks worth of grazing.
Right. You know, people that have never worked with temporary fencing, you know, look at it and they say, oh, man, I can't move a fence every 3 days. And the same people are getting on a tractor and trying to get to start in the middle of the winter time and muck carrying bales through the mud and dropping them in the mud, and it's just it's not maybe less work, but it's a different kind of work. And
you've got to get that shift in how you're thinking. I mean, a lot of times it's that back to that status quo. We're all that's that human nature in us that we want to do it like we've always done it. And if we're wanting to improve, and we're wanting, and the goal is, you know, to produce better pastures, that may take some changes. Well, it's not going to may. It is going to take some changes, and it may take several changes over a period of time. You don't have to tackle them all at one time, but. Yeah. We do have to.
And it's a lot better for our pastures. We're not out there rutting it up, doing those type things. It is absolutely better. It spreads that dung and urine out. From a fertility standpoint, that's a lot better. I mean, there's just all kinds of advantages to doing that.
Probably one of the biggest advantages that we haven't talked about is that stockpile grass is almost always higher in forage quality than most of the hay that we put up in Western Kentucky.
Absolutely.
And that's a big advantage, especially if you're in a fall calving system where your nutritional requirements are going to be higher in your cows this time of year. Yep. I will mention one thing about strip grazing that we didn't talk about, and it's a lesson people learn, but when you take one fence down, it's important to have another fence up. So you have to leapfrog your fences across. And
and that's more important in the summertime or spring, summer, then so in the fall when you can actually start at your water source and kind of move away from that.
Well, even in the fall, I guess what I was getting at is if you don't have a second fence up, the cows are going to be at the other end of the pasture when you're stockpiling. And I worked with a farm in Virginia when I was an extension specialist at Virginia Tech, and they had about 100-acre pasture they were stockpiling. And I forgot to mention that second fence, so that when they took that first fence down, the cows were at the other end of the 100 acres.
So. I'm with you now. I'm catching on. I couldn't understand what you're getting, but I'm with you now. But
that's another important point David brought up. The, you know, when you're stockpiling, you're not getting any regrowth on those pastures, so you don't need a back fence. Yeah. So you just start at your water source and kind of work away from that water source.
Yeah. Well, you know, when we go into a field and put up a fence for strip grazing, we try to do that whole field. That way, if they do get across or something happens, they're not getting to the very other end of the field. So we do try to do that. So that's smart.
You know, one of the advantages I've seen from different places where I've worked with producers who have stockpiled, and there's many, but one of the things I've noticed is that next season, we don't necessarily see the weed pressure coming in the spring because we stockpiled in the fall. And really what I think's happening there is we allow, if fescue's what we're grazing, we allow it to be as competitive as it can possibly be by growing. And we know how good a job it will do at shading out other weeds. So that's another thing that I've seen that folks get a benefit from that next spring. Chris, you mentioned just a minute ago not seeing some of the direct results from applying nitrogen sometimes. Do you think maybe that's because of the variability in water in a given fall, you know, the rainfall that we may or may not have?
It certainly is, and that could be an important factor. So really there's two primary factors. It's having enough water to grow, and sometimes that's a real challenge in the fall. Now, Matt Dixon, our UK meteorologist, said that our seasons are shifting towards warmer and wetter. So that's a positive for cow-calf producers in most situations in terms of growing grass. So that may be good for stockpiling. And then it's that nitrogen availability, but often it's moisture limited in the fall. When I was in Virginia, we had a producer that was an outstanding grazer, so he had strong nitrogen cycles as his pastures, good rotational management, and he made the decision to stop putting nitrogen on stockpile. He felt like because of moisture variability in the fall that money was better spent on buying a little extra hay. And then if it did get dry in the fall, he had that extra hay in his system.
Yeah, you know, and the one of the things that I try to, you know, to impress upon producers is that if the stockpile doesn't work, if you don't have the nitrogen, if you don't have that rainfall and that type of thing, you need to have enough hay to be able to feed. You know, it doesn't keep you from, you know, having, you still got to have enough hay. But I tell people, I still strip graze. Even the years that I put nitrogen on, we didn't get any rainfall. Stockpiling was very minimal. But we went on and strip grazed anyway, and then we would unroll hay, or we would do bale grazing now. Either way, you know, to spread that dung and urine around for that fertility, I think is just, I mean, I don't think you can beat that from that standpoint.
I think one of the best things we can do in terms of fertility program is implement some type of a hay feeding strategy that's moving those feeding points around. And that's exactly what bale grazing does. It's a little bit more focused in terms of setting the bales out. And we would go out in late fall and set those bales out while they're still dry, and then kind of strip graze through those bales. So they're getting kind of a combination of some stockpile grass and some bales. And that stockpile grass can often serve as a supplement to lower quality hay in those pastures. And by having those feeding points distributed through the pasture, we're capitalizing on the nutrients. And hey, I don't know, at current fertilizer prices, we've got about $80 worth of nutrients, just fertilizer nutrients, in a ton of hay. So so getting those distributed across the pasture is really important. And a lot of times when we see producers feed on farms, they'll choose an area that's close to a gate, and they'll just set their hay out there day after day after day all winter long. Those nutrients are not doing them any good that was in that hay, because they're all concentrated in one spot. We'd never take a fertilizer buggy and spread one corner of the pasture, right?
That's a good point.
but we essentially do the same thing by feeding hay in one spot in that pasture.
And I think, you know, over the years with cost share programs, one of the things that I know here, a lot of cattle producers have gotten cautious on those heavy feeding areas, which are, you know, we talked about those and the benefits of those, but it's interesting that you say that, because when you put those heavy feeding areas in, you put those in so you can feed there and try to keep them out of the mud, but it's, you're helping one thing, but then on the other side, like what you're talking about as far as the fertility part of it, it's a lot easier
to spread the fertilizer, if you will, if you're doing it differently than putting it all in a heavy use area.
Yeah.
Because you've got it all concentrated right there. So you still got to spread the manure somewhere.
Right.
So it seems like to me it's a lot easier to do it this way than it is to try to put it in a manure spreader and spread it.
Well, you know, as an organic nitrogen source, it's not all going to be available at the same time. It's going to be spread out over time as it changes. Therefore, it ought to be spread out over the field the same way. You don't want all that breaking down at one time. You want it being spread out over a larger area.
One of the challenges with the heavy use areas, well, there's a couple challenges, but one is that we don't capture all the nutrients in the heavy use area. Even if we scrape up what's there and carry it back out and spread it with a manure spreader on the pastures, we're losing a lot of the potassium and nitrogen that's in the urine that leaches down into that soil. One of the other challenges on heavy use areas, and I've never seen one that didn't have a mud issue with where they move in and out of the heavy use area.
That's
so
exactly
even if
right.
you do a great job with the heavy use area, they still have to get in and out of that heavy use area.
Yep.
And usually it's a sea of mud around it.
Right.
That's right.
Well, I know we've kind of covered pretty good the whole wintertime deal, but let's talk a little bit about what we can do to that summer slump, if you will, that happens about July, that runs through August, that fescue is not actively growing. You know, what are some things that we can do as producers? What are some things that they can do to fill those gaps?
So one of the more traditional approaches has been using some type of summer annual in the grazing system. And I say that kind of with a little bit of a cautious note, because I just had a graduate student finish and she did an economic analysis on summer annuals, and I cried when I read that chapter. It's tough economics with annuals and forage systems, especially a cow-calf system. So you have to use them sparingly, and you have to have a focused use of those. And to me, summer annuals are provide high-quality grazing, and they can be plentiful grazing during the summer months. But you have to be careful with how much you're investing per acre. Probably the best spot in a cow-calf system would be as part of a renovation schedule in a pasture. So if I say I identify a pasture that's weak on my farm, I'd go in there and I would plant summer annuals in that pasture. then that would give me some good summer grazing. I could come in the fall and then renovate that pasture. So that's a great tool to use for pasture renovation. They can also be used to introduce a novel endophyte tall fescue into a grazing system that doesn't have the toxic issues that our traditional tall fescue has in grazing systems.
Yeah, we've tried to do some of that too with sorghum sedan grass and some of those mm-hmm. things. And I wasn't quite ready after the first year of doing that, wasn't quite ready to renovate that pasture. So we came in and planted Marshall ryegrass that fall. And then we're going to come back again this spring, about May, and put sorghum sedan grass again. And then we're going to renovate in the fall. So you can kind of prolong however you want to spend your money, but you can kind of prolong that if you're not ready to renovate that pasture, or things kind of get away, time gets away from you, which does a lot of times here for those folks that are part-time farmers. That kind of time does kind of get away. So, you know, you can prolong that for a year if you need to.
Yep.
One of the things that with the summer annuals that some of our producers have asked me is they want the summer annuals in there, but, you know, sometimes they are going to aggressively grow, I guess would be a way to put that. And they can get away, if you're not managing them, they can get away from you. And I think I'm right in saying that, and you all kind of chime in here, but I know that's one of the things that some of my producers here, you know, they've been a little cautious because they don't know that they've got the time or the manpower, because a lot of times they're working off farm, like you had referenced earlier, and just not wanting that to get out of hand.
Well, you certainly don't want to plant half the farm in summer annuals. I think that's a disaster waiting to happen, because they go from 18 inches to 6 feet tall in a matter of a week or two. So it can be a real challenge staying on top of the grazing. A couple strategies you can use is you start to graze a little bit earlier than you think you should. So you probably want to get sorghum sedans get up to about 18 inches. That reduces the potential for prussic acid poisoning. Excuse me. And then the other strategy is you can stagger plantings. So by staggering plantings about 2 weeks as you go through the planting season, they'll be coming on at slightly different times.
Yeah, and you know, when we had to do that, and we probably started grazing a little earlier maybe than we wanted to, but then we also came back there and some of it probably got too mature before we could get, you know, before we could get it grazed. So those are some things you have to kind of pay attention to, and those type things, and with summer annuals. When we're talking about maybe getting some legumes started in our pastures, you know, how do we need to go about doing those things? How important is that to even stretch that grazing even further down the road?
So legumes, and our primary ones would be red and white clover. I mean, they're a really important part of grazing systems, and I think that they have even more importance as this nitrogen price gets high. Right now, nitrogen price is bouncing around 94 cents a pound for urea, as urea. And legumes can substitute for nitrogen in grazing systems. So I can't stress enough how important they are. And oftentimes we get obsessed with weed control in pastures. And when we use some of these, and we have some really good weed control products now that do a great job, but most of them will eliminate legumes from pastures. So the question is how do we get those in pastures? And our best vehicle for doing that is frost seeding in late winter. I mean, that's and that fits right hand in hand with stockpiling. So when we stockpile a pasture, we come in and we graze it close, and usually we're done grazing by February. And that gives us an ideal surface, that closely grazed sod, to frost seed legumes onto.
Another good reason to strip graze.
Another great reason to strip graze. And one of the mistakes people often make when they overseed pastures with the legumes is they don't control post-seeding competition. So we get in there and we broadcast in February, the freezing and thawing cycles incorporates that legume seed into the soil surface. Those seedlings germinate and then if we don't control that competition, that sod that's remaining will grow around those seedlings and shade them out. So the one of the best practices that we can do after we frost seed a pasture is just leave the animals in there and maybe feed a little bit of hay in that pasture. Because they'll keep nipping on anything that starts to grow back in that pasture, and that'll give those legumes a chance to come up and get established. And people are often worried that you're going to kill those legume seedlings, and you will kill some with hoof action and some will get nipped off. But if you don't control that competition, you'll lose the whole stand of legumes in there.
I think it's, you know, when you start talking about legumes too, always need to mention soil pH, and that can be a factor. I know that I've had some folks that have tried to do that, and really they thought they were doing everything right, and they were doing a lot right, but the one thing they forgot was to take a soil test. And oftentimes, a lot of times the issue is the soil pH is just, you know, too acid. That, you know, it's just too acid of a soil for those legumes to really perform like we want them to.
So that's a great point, Vicki. The improved legumes like red and white clover, they like adequate soil fertility. So it doesn't mean we have to be in the high range for phosphorus and potassium, but we want to be in the medium range for sure. If we want a soil pH that's going to be between 6 and 6.4 for those improved legumes. One of the challenges that people often have is that they have rented land, and that if that rented land is on a short-term lease, making long-term applications of fertilizer and lime is a challenge for them. And one of the things that we can do with frost seeding is we can incorporate some annual Lespedeza into that mixture of red and white clover. So if we put on, say, 4 to 6 pounds of red clover, a pound of an improved white clover like a Ladino clover, and then 10 pounds of annual Lespedeza, that's a good mixture for these farms where we don't have the resources or the lease to invest in lime and fertilizer.
Yeah, you make a great point. And when we're talking about liming and keeping our soil pH correct, you know, and I've always heard lime is the poor man's fertilizer. So, you know, and Dr. Toyce, talk with us a little about, say I have a piece of rented ground and it really does need lime and the pH is not where it needs to be. How many years, just for folks' information, would you say that somebody had to have that lease to be able to recoup those costs from liming that pasture?
Well, I've never quite done the economics on that, so it's a great question. but I'd want it for, if I had a 5-year lease, I'd be pretty comfortable putting lime on, you know, but 3 years may be a minimum, I guess. Mm-hmm. Lime doesn't act immediately, so it takes a little while to work over the first year or two. So I'd say 3 years would be the minimum. And lime is, right now at the current fertilizer prices, lime has stayed about the same in cost, maybe a little bit higher because of trucking. So really, if you do a soil test and it indicates that you need lime, it's probably your best investment. And lime does several things to the soil. It neutralizes soil acidity, but it also makes nutrients that are in the soil more plant available. So that's really important in times of high fertilizer price. So if we can put lime on, that's a good investment right now. It's going to make phosphorus and potassium more available and nitrogen more available in the soil to the plants.
Well, one thing, go ahead, Vicki.
I was just going to say, sometimes too, when you know, when you're talking about lease ground, that, you know, where to lime, when to lime, and how many years you have to have it too. And, you know, in some cases too, that might be a conversation that you have with the landowner, and maybe adjust that lease agreement, because if the producer is going to be the one putting the lime on, then that lease rate sometimes may need to be discussed. Or if that's the producer's responsibility, I mean, that could be a conversation to have to be able to maintain that ground like it needs to be maintained, and both parties be happy.
You know, Vicki, I think that your background in grain production coming out, because I had the exact same thought. I have encouraged landowners before, when they're negotiating leases, to be willing to be responsible for maintaining the soil pH, let that fall back on them, and then they don't have to worry about a producer in a short-term lease agreement mining that out of their ground. You know, that's something they're always going to be responsible for, and it's really setting them up for that next lease to know that that's going to be there, especially if they're in a situation where the part of that lease agreement is anything other than just cash. If it's production related, from a landowner standpoint, they're going to benefit for that production to be as high as possible as well. So good point.
Yeah, I actually worked with a landowner this summer that has this situation. They had just bought the property, and the people that had it before were just letting people cut hay off of it, and they were taking it a year after year after year and putting very minimal fertilizer, no lime. Soil pH was, close to probably 5.5, 5.6. So the new person that they were going to lease it to was going to come in and they were going to put the lime. Well, the landowner is in the service, and they were concerned that, hey, if I have to move in 2 or 3 years, how do I handle this? And so I suggested to them that they just kind of take the total lime cost and prorate that out over 5 years. Mm-hmm. Is what is the figure that I used. And they were very happy with that. So that's maybe something folks can do to try to, to help alleviate some of those costs. If the farmer is worried about, I don't know if I'm going to have this for 5 years or that type of thing, maybe they can then prorate it out like that.
I almost think that we could do an entire show, and that gives me an idea. I need to make a note on that, just on land leasing, both from the producer and the landowner standpoint. Chris, you've touched on a lot of different points dealing with stockpiling. Talk a little bit about turnout dates, and I know that may range from year to year with the amount of production that might be done, but talk a little bit to us about the importance of that.
In terms of stockpiling?
Yes.
Yeah, so ideally you'd want to delay it until we get into at least late November or December would be ideal. And and during that period, you're going to have kind of what I call a dead period where you don't have much to graze. You can actually feed some hay, and your neighbors will look at you like you're crazy, right? Because and David knows, yeah. Because he's got grass in the pasture, and here that guy is feeding hay. What's wrong with him?
Yeah.
But that's a good way to allow that grass to stockpile. The other thing that delaying initiation of grazing of stockpile does is if you have a toxic tall fescue pasture, ergovaline levels, which is the toxin in tall fescue, can be pretty high in the fall. And by delaying it until after we get some good freezes, we'll see those ergovaline concentrations decrease significantly in those stockpile pastures.
Hey, it's not always a bad idea to get your neighbor's opinion or, their attention, because then you can turn it into a teachable moment.
Absolutely. And the thing about putting out hay in the fall versus putting out hay in the winter, it's not near as muddy in the fall a lot of times as it is in the winter. So that being able to go out there without being so bundled up I can't get my knife out of my pocket to cut the strings off the hay rolls, is kind of a plus to me, and that type thing. So, it works really good. But I have had people look at me like I had about three heads. Matter of fact, I did a meeting here in Webster County.
Yes, you did.
And about that, and they were taken aback a little bit about how we did things. So,
but it also started conversations.
Yeah, absolutely.
About going back to that shifting that
mentality,
mindset,
yeah,
of what you can do to make improvements.
Right. Yep.
Well, good deal, folks. That's been wonderful discussion so far. And Chris, we appreciate you bringing that information to us. And we want to talk a little bit about our weekly topic that we do. We change every week, but we wanted you to be able to join in on this with us. And this week's topic is tips for livestock producers to weather high fertilizer prices. We've done some shows on this in the past as far as grain production goes, but what would be some of the tips you would think of right offhand for landowners and producers alike to weather some of these high fertilizer prices?
So the first thing that always happens when fertilizer prices go up is that you see these miracle cures for fertilizer. People just come out of the woodwork, and I just want to say that there is no silver bullet for those. And if they're telling you can put a half a quart of this on or that on a pasture and it's gonna neutralize your soil acidity and make your phosphorus more available, it's probably a lie. So just don't use those. Your best tool is going to be soil testing. And people say, well, fertilizer prices are so high, I'm not even going to bother soil testing. It's more important to soil test when fertilizer prices are high because it allows you to target your application. So instead of putting on a 10-10-10, you put on just the phosphorus you need and just the potassium you need on that pasture. So that's a really great tool. And the second tip I would have, kind of already talked about it, is if you need to lime your pastures, as indicated by a soil test, you know, this is a great time to do it because lime prices have remained relatively stable.
Yeah, it's probably one of the cheaper things that you'll be able to do this coming spring or right now or whenever you can get it done. But that's probably one of the cheapest things you can get done from a fertility standpoint.
Well, and too, with using that soil test too, I mean, sometimes it can cost you more money to not fertilize dependent. If you've got that soil test to really know what you've got and taking that guesswork out of it, you know, sometimes you know that saying you're going to spend $10 to save $5. You can get yourself in a situation like that because we think fertilizer is just too high. I can't do it. But in the long run, it could cost you more money not doing it.
Right.
You know, and soil testing will allow you to target those nutrients where they're actually needed, not just from a standpoint of what the soil test says, but when you know the fertility capabilities of a given piece of ground, you know you can put a little more attention to the places where you're going to get that higher production from, and maybe in years like this, scrimp or cut back in those places that aren't normally as productive.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And Dr. Grove, our soil scientist at the research station, and I just wrote an article on 10 tips to handle high fertilizer prices in forage livestock operations. And of course, one of those tips was soil testing. Another one of those tips were that when we're in a medium range for soil tests, we could get a little bump in yield in pastures if we put a little more phosphorus and potassium on, but it's going to be pretty minimal. We've achieved more than 80% of the potential production in those pastures when we're in the medium soil test range. So right now our recommendation is if you're in the center of the medium range, you should probably just hold off on P&K fertilizer applications.
You know, I think that's something that we probably haven't talked about ever that I can remember is when those levels are in those ranges about, you know, with, I guess because fertilizer prices haven't been that bad, that you can afford to go on and put some to try to capture that 20% that you don't have. But you know, mining a little bit of that P and K out right now, if you have the right levels in your pasture, I think is something that folks probably should take advantage of this year.
And you can't guess that.
No,
you can't get. You think you can, but you cannot guess that unless you have historically been taking soil tests and maybe you haven't taken a few in the last couple of years, and you still need to take another one. But
yeah,
you know, I think that's key. You can't guess it.
I'll throw another variable out there to go along with that, and that's knowing what you're pulling off of that soil. And that's going to be different for different crops, whether we're stockpiling fescue, whether it's summer hay production, right? We having an idea of the specific species that you're growing and knowing what its necessities are, knowing what it's going to pull out of the ground. I think you'd be money ahead to know that as well.
So one of the beautiful things about a cow-calf system is that we remove very few nutrients from that system. I mean, if we look at a cow-calf system, 80 to 90% of the nutrients that go in the front end of the animal are coming out the back end of the animal. And that makes those systems very sustainable. So if you have a medium soil test or a medium plus soil test in a pasture, the need for commercial fertilizer in terms of P&K are going to be pretty low. I mean, you should still monitor it and put a little bit on now and then, but that makes these kind of a systems, if they're well managed going into high fertilizer prices, very sustainable.
Yeah, so, you know, you don't have to, when you're in a cow-calf operation, you're really not mining that much P P and K, unless you're cutting hay off of those pastures. And that's the key. That's the key. If you're cutting hay off of a pasture, you will definitely need to put P and K on no matter what. You know, it just takes so much out of the soil. So, you know, folks, producers just need to keep those kind of things in mind when they're, and you need to formulate a plan. And on the show in the past, we've talked about you need to have a plan A and probably a plan B, but this year you may need a plan C and D. It's the same with pasture, you know, and those type things, and hay production. You need to have all of those in place for sure.
Before leaving the fertilizer topic there, timing of application. Talk about that for a minute, because I think that also becomes very important, especially in these high fertilizer prices. You're trying to get the biggest bang for the buck. And, you know, doing the soil tests and knowing what you have is important. And like Jay said, you know, knowing your production and all of that. But talk a minute about the importance of the timing of the application.
So there's a couple different things to think about when we're talking about timing. Lime can go on any time that's dry enough to get a lime truck on. That's not going to matter that much. As far as P and K, we can put those on any time. If we're in a hay situation, we can get into a situation where we have something called luxury consumption of potassium in the spring. So what that means in terms of timing is that we want to put a little bit of fertilizer on, but we probably want to put a split application of potassium on. Luxury consumption means the plant takes up more than it actually needs to grow. And when that happens, we're taking more potassium away from that pasture than that hay field than we really need to. So by splitting that application and putting a little bit on after the first cutting in the spring, if you're in alfalfa especially, and then a second application and even a third application in very intensive hay systems, and spoon feeding that fertilizer under those pastures, we're going to get more efficient use of those nutrients. In terms of nitrogen applications, if we're putting nitrogen on to stimulate growth in the spring, which generally I don't recommend for pastures, because spring nitrogen applications of pastures stimulates more growth, and we already have too much growth, or more growth than we can utilize by grazing, and then we're making that problem worse with additional nitrogen fertilizer. If you're going to fertilize in a cow-calf system, you're better off to spend that fertilizer in the fall in most cases. Not all cases, but most cases. Now, hay situation is a little bit different. We want to time that nitrogen application with the growth of whatever we're trying to harvest as hay. So if it's a cool season pasture or a cool season hay field.
Chris, relative to the nitrogen needs, you were talking just a little bit about what we need. You talked a little bit about springtime not really needing that nitrogen amount. I think it'd be a good time to throw in that ideally if we were making productive use of legumes in our pasture, we should have some of those nitrogen availabilities in the spring. So just tell us a little bit more about that.
So in terms of grazing systems, a lot of times when we put nitrogen on in the spring, we stimulate that extra growth that we can't utilize through grazing. And so if we're going to spend money on nitrogen in the spring, money on nitrogen in cow-calf systems, we're better off to put it on in the fall. Now, in terms of hay production, we want to stimulate that growth in the spring because we're going to get the majority of our yield from that first cutting in the spring. So it's going to be important to time that nitrogen to the growth of the plant. So in terms of cool season grasses like tall fescue and orchard grass, we want to probably put it on in late February, early March as that plant's starting to grow in the spring. And it can grab that nitrogen so it can't escape from the system and utilize it to produce dry matter production. Now, in some cases, as you get into the purchase, people are using warm season grasses like Bermuda grass for hay production. And that's a great producer, but the nitrogen application timing is different on that. So instead of putting it on in late February or March when that plant would be dormant during that period, we want to put it on in later spring. So as we get into June would be a much better time to put it on.
Those have all been great tips. And as we move along, we're going to talk a little bit about our timely tip. And this week's timely tip is, and Dr. Toitz, we want you to chime in on all this. Feed your worst hay first and your better hay during calving or or supplement them when needed. You know, and the best way to know what your hay, what you have, is to test your hay.
Yep, absolutely. And there's no way to look at hay and tell, you know, the crude protein or the energy concentration of that hay. You really have to have a hay test. And then that allows you to start to manage that hay. And like David said, we can feed the lower quality hay when the nutritional requirements of the herd is the lowest. And that's the ideal situation. And match the better hay when their nutritional requirements, say, as in early lactation, would be higher.
Ideally, you want to be grazing stockpile grass when that lactation, when they're calving and doing those type things, where the nutrition value of that stockpile grass is so much better, you know, and that's ideally you'd like to be doing that, and then supplement when you need to. But you know, absolutely feed your worst hay. Her requirements are like, do you know, Dr. Toits, right off the top of your head, like in gestation, what their requirements are?
So gestation, you know, we're probably looking at a crude protein concentration of 7 to 8%. So very low crude protein concentration, and then energy levels would be, you know, somewhere in that 50 to 55% range. So lower quality hay would meet those requirements. As we get into early lactation, we're looking at 60% TDN requirement and crude protein of 10 to 11%.
And so we're probably doing that backwards. Everybody is. And when I was growing up, we were doing it backwards from what we really should be doing. And that's the whole really should be doing is grazing stockpile grass and supplementing those cows with better quality hay when they're calving. And
you know, when you measure I've measured crude protein concentrations in stockpile grass that are 16% in February. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing how high they can be, and 60% TDN.
Yeah, and that's kind of a misnomer folks have thought about for years, is that stockpile grass is not as nutritionally rich as it actually is, and that kind of falls all the way into March, really. Yeah. It's better than probably some of the hay that you're ever going to put up.
Right. And it does drop off. As we get into late winter, the quality of the stockpile will drop off. There's no question about that, but... In January and February, it's going to be hard to beat stockpile grass in terms of nutritional quality. One other thing I wanted to mention with the hay feeding is that the best place to feed hay is going to be on some of your worst pastures, or those pastures where you need those nutrients at. So just think about that, and there's no way to know that unless you do a soil test, right, Vicki?
That's so. Right.
Well, you know, talking about nutritional soundness, and David, you're talking about this timely tip, feeding that good hay at a time when the cow's going to need it the most. I'm thinking farther down the road.
You know, we did a study when we first started doing this winter grazing, and we actually dry lotted those cows for about 3 months, and those cows actually put on 135 pounds on some hay that was about a 50-51% TDN, and it was about 10% crude protein. But you know, they can put on weight in a dry lot on hay, you know, and to me that helps really going into that calving period and having them in really good shape. You want to have that body condition score about a 6 or so, or in that neighborhood, but when she goes into calving. So because that rebreeding deal is, if cows don't get rebred, you're not making any money. And it's hard to do that. So,
well, everybody, that sounds good. Dr. Toits, we appreciate you being with us this week. You've certainly added a lot to the program, and we appreciate it. We want to thank you and our hosts for this week's information, and thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you have enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.